Hello, welcome to the Theology Pugcast. It's great to have you with us for this episode. We are here in Memphis, Tennessee with a live audience. Yeah, we don't do this enough. And in fact, all three of us are actually in the same room. We don't do that very much anymore because we're in different parts of the country. But anyway, I'm C.R. Wiley. I'm a pastor. I serve a church in the Pacific Northwest. I've written a number of books, the latest of which is In the House of Tom Bombadil. And anyway, let me just kick it over to you, Tom. Tell us a little about yourself.
I'm Tom Price. I teach theology, ethics, and philosophy. And yes, it's a joy for me to be back in the presence with Glenn and Chris and guests. We, under strange circumstances, have been faithful in recording, but it's always better in person.
yeah, that's right. Glenn.
Glenn Sunshine. I'm a senior fellow at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, a retired and recovering historian, and a ministry associate at Reflections Ministries. My latest book is 32 Christians Who Changed Their World.
And we are joined today by an old friend, someone who's been on the show before, George Grant. George, how you doing? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm doing great, and it is great to be with you guys again. It's always fun to catch you remotely, but I think, Tom, you're right. It's so much better face-to-face and to be able to be here. I'm also a teaching elder in the Presbyterian Church in America. That's why I'm here in Memphis. That and the barbecue.
That's right. Let's be honest.
And I, too, have written so many books that most of them are now out of print and available in garage sales throughout the South.
Me too.
Right. Excellent. Is this one of yours?
So, yes, next week, a book that I've been trying to get published for probably 10 years, a book by Isaac Watts on lifetime learning, is now out.
All right.
And will be released at the Classical Schools Conference in Pittsburgh this next week. And
all right.
I am so delighted. Isaac Watts, the father of English hymnody, over 1,000 hymns. His practice was to write a new hymn or psalm setting for every sermon he preached.
Oh, man. Man, make you feel like you're not doing anything.
Yeah, and he was a successor to the great John Owen at the Mark Lane Chapel.
Yeah.
He wrote a slew of other theology books.
And a logic text, is that correct?
A logic text that was the primary logic textbook for Cambridge, Oxford, and Harvard for generations. But the sequel to that book was a book on lifetime learning. And that has been out of print largely for several generations. And it's really golden. And I've wanted it published. And I finally, through tenacity, have pulled the wool over somebody's eyes. And it's now going to be published.
Yeah, considering the person behind it and all of that, I'm sure it's rich. Do we want to talk about that today? We're kind of leaving it in your court to kind of take us where we want. You know, we did a little teaser.
I thought we were going to talk about American history, or let's talk about architecture. I'm ready to talk about architecture.
Yeah, wherever you want to go.
The next tour, yes.
Yeah, wherever you want to go, George, we're ready for the ride.
I'm headed off to Scotland in September and October. One of my areas of academic interest is Thomas Chalmers, the great 19th century Scottish reformer, who was an apologist like Doug. He was a brilliant strategist, a partner with William Wilberforce in the abolition of the slave trade. He was heralded by Spurgeon as the greatest preacher since the Apostle Paul. And he's largely unknown.
Yeah.
And so I've been working on Chalmers projects for ages. And Karen and I, my wife and I, love to stay in the little Fifeshire fishing village where he grew up. There's almost nothing there except two great pubs and a coffee shop.
That's all you need.
So we're going to go, and hopefully I'll be underway with what will... I've done several small Chalmers projects, But what I'm working on next is a big biography.
Wow. Well, let's kind of roll with this a little bit. So this is something to think about. We often think that if we're going to make a difference, if we're going to do something glorious, that we've got to go to some place like New York City or Los Angeles, you know, the center of like cultural power to get it done. But here's right. a guy who, this is where he was born, you said?
He was born in this little town, Anstruther. It's mm-hmm. spelled Anstruther, mm-hmm. Right on the Fifeshire coast. And he went to St. Andrews mm-hmm. at the age of 11. Mm-hmm. And then at the age of 19 was ordained, even though at the time the Scottish church required you to be 21. He was so precociously brilliant that they broke their rule
and
ordained him at 19.
Yeah.
But here's the catch. He went on and he pastored a little church in Kilmeny, which is a tiny, tiny little village, about 20 miles from St. Andrews. Mm. And for the first 4 years that he was there, he was still unconverted.
Wow.
But in a series of calamitous family events and in his own sickness, he came to understand the gospel, and it was radically transformative.
Yeah, yeah.
He stayed there in Kilmeny for the next several years and started Bible societies, which helped launch the Bible society movement, missionary societies, which helped launch the missionary movement. He began to disciple young men like the Bonar brothers, like Robert Murray McShane, a host of others, Robert Chalmers Burns, and just an extraordinary number of young men who ultimately transformed the missions movement mm-hmm. and the Bible Society movement and the evangelical movement for a generation.
Yeah.
And Chalmers is forgotten.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he was the fountainhead of all of it.
Yeah, they knew not Joseph. That's kind of the thing.
But you know, a generation ago, nobody knew anything about Bavinck either.
Yeah,
and we've
had
this great resurgence of Bavinck studies, which has been enormously helpful.
Right.
And so I think, Chalmers may be next.
Well, so when we think about a person like this man, who's so prolific, so kind of capacious and effective in his work, and, you know, he's a pastor, so tell us a little bit about, can you get into like his daily routines or, you know, what made him what he was?
Well, he wrote a tremendous amount, a lot of books. He was prolific in letter writing, his collection
Talk
of
about
letters.
Making you feel guilty.
Well, his collection of letters published by Banner of Truth reveals a lot about his life patterns. But after his conversion, he decided to make an intense study of the New Testament. And one of the things that he did was he attempted to identify what he called the keystone verse for every chapter in the New Testament. Hmm. And then he would memorize that verse. And his theory was that with 6 memorized verses, he would have the arc of the entire argument of the book of Ephesians.
Right, right.
The arc of the entire argument of the book of Galatians.
Right.
And with just 6 memorized verses. He did this for every book in the New Testament, and then, but he never wrote it down. His disciples would talk about it. McShane talks about how Chalmers would use this method as a kind of a Lectio Divina approach to each chapter of the New Testament. Mm. And that's the way he discipled young men. And they would walk through the streets of St. Andrews quoting their keystone verses as they made their way to Lord's Day worship. Mm. And it was radically transformative. So one of the things that he obviously did was he spent a great deal of time just digging deep into the scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
He believed that it was necessary to set aside at least 3 hours every single day for intense study of the scriptures mm-hmm. if you were going to be an effective teacher mm-hmm. of the Word of God. He also believed in evangelism, and so he was a pioneer in the recovery of the old parish ministry model. Okay. He visited every single member of his parish. And by every single member of his parish, I don't mean every single member of his church.
Right.
I mean everybody in the community he visited and attempted to disciple or minister to or bring comfort to.
Right.
And he attempted to do that four times every year.
Wow.
So he literally made the circuit.
So how large would the community have been when he was doing this?
Well, Kilmeny and the area around it at that time would have been about 15,000 people.
Wow.
So he would see 15,000 people four times a year.
That's, again, something that makes you feel really guilty.
And he would write letters.
And write letters, yeah. Right.
You
maybe it was to a lot of these people.
And 3 hours.
I was at your house yesterday and you weren't there. Where were you? Yeah. I'm having a little fun.
And we think 4 emails a year these days.
That's
really laborious.
Anyway.
Well, George, real quick.
Yeah.
You probably find this, I think we know similarly. It tends to be people like that get more done with that kind of schedule. Seems that we have, again, all these devices to make things quicker, but we're getting so few things done. Even study, to do 3 hours of scripture a day was, I understand that the world was set up differently then, but still what they filled in a day didn't slow things down. And there is something about that kind of, I think it's a spiritual reality that as one is oriented towards the things of God the right way, that productivity is a byproduct.
Yeah, you know, I have a number of friends who have begun to take disciplinary action in their own lives to get rid of some of the clutter, to make sure that their study is not just cluttered with electronic devices, to have a place where you can go to sit, to actually read, where you're not constantly being beeped and buzzed and rung up and all of the rest. And I think that that's something that that we can begin to implement. We don't have to be Luddites in the rejection of technology to recognize that the patterns of our lives have become utterly mad. When you walk into a restaurant and you see 5 families sitting there and 4 of the 5, every single person is staring at their phone. Or, you know, the madness of walking into the Sistine Chapel and seeing people trying to take selfies. And they don't ever actually look up.
Yeah, yeah. They're too busy looking at themselves looking up.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that Chalmers reminds me of is the incredible value of slowing down, going deep, making relationships actually matter.
Yeah.
And doing this all for the glory of God, for the building up of the kingdom. And while we are sacrificing, in a sense, worldly pleasure to build up the kingdom, what we find is something far greater than worldly pleasure. Mm. We find joy.
Yeah. Right. Now, you know, you and I and Chalmers, we share the same profession.
We're all hobbits. Well, you may be Tom Bombadil, but I'm just a hobbit.
But, you know, I see sometimes some photographs that you share about your library and the environment that you do your work in. Some of the things that you're doing with regard to how you order your own life due to your appreciation for, you know, Chalmers and others and what you've learned from them?
Well, one of the things I think is really important is to recognize that beauty, goodness, and truth all go together.
Right.
We tend to zero in on one or another of those things, but it's really important to be surrounded by beauty. I love Edith Schaeffer's whole notion that a meal is not a meal without a vase filled with flowers, as she would say.
Right.
I, you know, otherwise it's just fuel.
Right, right.
So part of one of the, part of what Karen and I do in our home is we just, you don't have to spend a lot of money, but surround yourself with beauty, surround yourself with the things that that really create a sense of delight and settledness. And that's an important thing. The other thing is we do actually read, and we take Neil Postman's admonition that one of the most powerful things that anyone can do to resist the lure of the world in these days is to unplug things.
Right, right. Yeah. So unplug things, but then maybe also give yourself something good to read.
Right, right. Yeah. And we Karen and I both start every day with the scriptures. We spend time in the Word. We do multiple sorts of Bible programs at the same time. I have a read-through plan, and then I have sort of a zeroing in devotional plan. And then, because I'm a preacher, I have the stuff that I've got to work on. I try and develop a reading plan for every year, the books that I want to read. I'm in a season of travel right now, so I'll be on airplanes a lot. So I always try and have a good audiobook. For instance, right now I'm listening to 22 glorious hours of Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose.
George, one thing I think you said that's really important that I think is often overlooked. There are different ways of reading the Bible.
Yes.
And each of them has its own value.
Yes.
So I learned this because at one point I was going through Richard Foster's Celebration of Discipline. And in the study guide there on the chapter on prayer, it said, read through all four Gospels in one sitting and notice everything Jesus has to say about prayer.
Yeah.
And I was in seminary. I had never read that much of the Bible at one time.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And I realized that when you do that, you get something completely different out of it than when you read it pericope by pericope.
Yeah,
absolutely. Right. And if you see it from that 40,000 foot level going really fast, you see things you would never see otherwise. Patterns, repetitions, phrases. The Old Testament starts to bleed through in ways that are unexpected, in that you always see it in Matthew, but all of a sudden you start seeing it with such clarity in John and Luke and Mark, and it's so powerful.
Yeah. So you've got that. You've also got devotional reading. In my case, I like to do Lectio Divina. You get something totally different out of that than you do from the other.
Yes.
And then in-depth study is yet another way of doing it.
Yes.
So I like the way you integrate all of those, because that, you know, each of them, it's something I don't think most people appreciate. Each of them has its own unique value, and they're complementary.
Yeah, and they give you entirely different things. One of the things that I try to do at least once every 2 years is I try to read the entire canon of the scriptures from Genesis to Revelation in a single month.
Wow.
And it means that I'm not reading much else, reading a lot, but my goodness, what you see is extraordinary. And the echoing voices, if you're in Genesis, you know, one day, and 3 days later you're in Numbers, you're seeing things that are very, very different. And it's so rich and so powerful. I highly recommend that as a discipline. It's something that you might not be able to do in the workaday world. So do it when you're on vacation or something like that.
Now, when it comes to the practical kind of task of accomplishing what you just described, we all struggle with inattentiveness, you know, wandering thoughts, find ourselves maybe having actually thought we read something and we didn't. We say, well, where am I in this book? I don't think I remember anything I've read for the last 15 minutes.
Right.
Are there any tips that you could give us in terms of how to maybe approach something like that?
When I start getting weary, and I still have a lot of reading to do, one of the things that I do is I stand up, start walking around, and I read out loud.
Okay. Mm.
Reading silently is actually incredibly helpful, but it also cuts off a large portion of particularly beautiful writing.
Yeah.
Because you need to hear the rhythms. Mm. The alliteration, you can see it on the page, but if you're reading silently, you're not hearing it. And all of a sudden, it becomes musical. If I'm reading the Puritans, if I'm, like right now I'm reading John Owen, if I'm reading Owen, I can easily get bogged down on point 27 and realize I think I've missed the previous 19 points. But if I read it out loud, it starts to stick to my ribs, and I start to realize, okay, I know where this is going. And then the walking around part, you know, part of that is just I'm a preacher, and I can't confine myself to being behind the pulpit. Right. So I wander a great deal. And so if I'm reading out loud in my library, it might drive Kieran crazy upstairs or whatever, right. But I find that there is a beautiful rhythm in that, and it causes me to be much more alert.
Now, we've talked about reading scripture, which is obviously... Go ahead.
Let me jump in here. Yeah. In the Middle Ages, when you were doing Lectio Divina, the first step is Lectio. It's reading.
Right.
And they always did it out loud.
Yes.
Because they want to engage the body, not just the mind and the spirit.
Yeah.
And so that action of reading out loud, I think we underestimate it.
Yeah, as Peter Gilchrist famously stole from Augustine, there is a physical side to being spiritual.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. I mean, we see this. I remember one of my professors who did a lot of writing on the incarnation and the sacraments, noting how the whole thing about the sense of smell, the sense of hearing, all these senses are part of that redemption in incarnation. And they're brought up into it. So the spiritual and the embodied can't be detached. And so, yeah, we oftentimes look at past theologians and practices as, oh, that's just out of date. And it was kind of clueless based on what we know now. But it was actually engaging dimensions like that that we tend to ignore, especially when we divide oftentimes the material from the spiritual or blend them too much into each other.
You just mentioned Karen, maybe overhearing you walk around and read out loud. So getting to the practical side of this. So let's say you're a very self-conscious person and you're in a house full of other people. You know, what are the things that you need to do to kind of address this? Like, this is great advice, but if, like, you're a mother and you've got two or three little people that are needing your attention and you're reading out loud and kind of wandering around and you're feeling very self-conscious about this, you know, any thoughts on any of that? Like, obviously, having a nice study is great.
Right.
Close the door and maybe put some extra soundproofing up. But anything else you can do?
Yeah, go outside.
You can annoy the neighbors.
Well, this is another thing I think, Glenn, that's really important. There's a difference in reading the scriptures or reading George Herbert poetry or even reading The Highwayman came riding. The Highwayman came riding up to the old inn door. Mm. There's something different about doing that outside. Mm. Than inside. You've seen enough BBC movies to realize that taking a stroll around the garden with a book of poetry becomes this kind of a cultural iconic moment. Yeah. There's something to that.
Yeah.
Reading Wordsworth and Coleridge outside is very different than reading Wordsworth and Coleridge inside. And reading Byron outside is the only place to read Byron, because you sure don't want your wife to hear you.
You kind of feel indecent. Now, when we think about sort of the range of things to read, you know, obviously, as Christians, we place an emphasis on Scripture that has pride of place. How do we mix in other things, though? Is there an appropriate sort of weighting of different kinds of things to read? Have you thought about that?
Well, yes, and I've thought about it a lot because I've taught literature to high school and college students, and I've done reading programs for adults, and there are seasons in life where a young mom is just not going to have the time to do the kind of reading that she really would want to do. And it's really important, I think, for us, particularly in the classical Christian education world and the world of podcasts and everything, to simply say to moms, it's okay. Right. Another day is coming. You will have the opportunity. And right now, that's not what you're supposed to do. So I think one of the things we have to recognize are seasons in life and be realistic about what we can do. People create these lists of books that they want to read in the course of the year, and they feel so defeated at the end of the year when they've not gotten through it. So to be realistic is, I think, the first thing. The second thing is to find people that you really respect and admire, and don't just read what they've written, read what they're reading. You know,
Okay.
I think that's a really, that's a lesson that I learned about the founding fathers. To read what the founding fathers wrote is helpful, but to read what the founding fathers read is transformative.
Yeah, I've often thought, you know, when it comes to, say, Calvin, I just wish more Calvinists would read things that Calvin read.
Right. You start to realize why Calvin loved John Chrysostom.
You start to realize,
oh my goodness, he read the patristic fathers, and he soaked it in, and he was able to separate the wheat from the chaff, and he did so gladly, recognizing that even in his own day, there would be wheat and chaff. And of course, he heavily leaned on Pierre Viret, another of the greats who is largely forgotten but ought not to be. He had the largest church in Geneva. He was, Calvin believed that he was this incredible preacher, and he oftentimes would sit and just listen to Viret preach so that he could learn how to preach. There's so much richness there.
Well, I often said, you know, I would probably have more money in life if there weren't all the different books listed at the bottom of the page of the people I read. But that's usually where I put my library
together.
That's
so true.
That's right. You're a poor but rich man.
That's right.
One thing to keep in mind about Chalmers in this context is he had servants.
Late in life he did.
At least the housekeeper, those kinds of things.
Yes.
So that ends up offloading a certain amount of time because people are taking care of things for him.
Yeah, he did not marry until rather late into his Kilmeny pastorate, but his sister came and kept house for him. And so that was you know, really important. Then when he eventually moved to St. Andrews, to Glasgow, and to Edinburgh, in each of those places he did have servants.
Yeah. Someone, you know, again, someone taking care of the house matters a huge amount.
Absolutely. And Chalmers had five daughters as well, and they
helped out.
They whipped him into shape.
Now, when we think about, say, other kinds of reading, so, you know, just a little while ago you quoted Postman or alluded to Neil Postman. So obviously you're not just reading devotional literature, you're not just reading scripture, you're reading more broadly, you're reading biographies, reading other kinds of things. What are the things that you tend to read? I mean, what give us a sense of your sort of scope.
I read pretty much almost anything except trash. Mm-hmm. I try to avoid the trash, but increasingly that's harder and harder to avoid. I love detective stories.
Oh, okay,
fine. I love adventure fiction. I have read every single one of the John Buchan adventure stories, and I love those. He sort of created the genre that gave us James Bond and all the rest. I love biographies. You know, Andrew Roberts right now is my favorite biographer. His biography, I've probably read 10 or 12 biographies of Winston Churchill, And so I thought, when I saw his great big fat biography of Churchill, I thought, well, yeah, maybe it'll be all right. There was something new on every page. It was extraordinary. And his biography on King George is mind-boggling. It's just absolutely mind-boggling, called The Last King of America. It's brilliant. So his biography of Napoleon's wonderful. Paul Johnson is one of my favorite historians. Colin Thubrin is one of my favorite travel writers. I love reading travel adventure stories. So, I read poetry. Umberto Eco is one of my all-time heroes. I've got every book that he has written, philosophical, his wordplay stuff, his, you know, signs stuff.
You were reading his stuff on recently. I saw it somewhere on his art and beauty. Was that, what's the book?
Yeah. That was based on his doctoral dissertation on the beauty of and art in Thomas Aquinas' theology. It's really, really good and great for a good hard-nosed Presbyterian to read because it just opens up your world in remarkable ways.
Nice. Well, to that point, what are some things that you'd like to see us, say, in the Reform world getting into when it comes to our reading? You just mentioned something by Eco.
Yeah, I think that we need to read broadly and deeply. We need to know our stories. I think C.S. Lewis's advice in his introduction to Athanasius's On the Incarnation is right, and that is that we should read at least two old books for every new one that we read. He says, you know, reading outside of our time really opens up a whole different perspective for us. And books from the future would be just as good as books from the past, but they're just harder to get. So we need to read broadly. We need to read deeply. We need to read multiple genres to make us have better facility. Mm-hmm. Those of us who are responsible to stand at the sacred desk and open the Word of God to our people week by week, we need to know what our people are reading. Mm-hmm. So when my students were just all agog over Harry Potter, I read Harry Potter. Sure, when they became agog over Hunger Games, I read the Hunger Games books. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know what they were reading. Mm-hmm. And so that I could interact with all of that. Yes. We have a responsibility, I think, in the modern world to be conversant. And I think, you know, in the previous podcast, when Doug was talking about the necessity of asking questions and knowing what others in our world have experienced, I think that's really important. And so our reading should reflect that. I also really believe in following the rabbit trail. I used to tell my students, if we'd get off track in a conversation, I used to tell them, it's okay, the rabbit trail is the point.
That's actually the secret to the podcast. We have a general idea of what we're going to talk about.
Really? You have a general idea at the beginning of this?
Well, actually maybe that. Not.
We thought we did.
But I think, you know, sometimes we forget that it's the process. It's the journey, not necessarily all of the benchmarks along the way. It's just the journey that sparks our imagination and quickens our heart and causes new interests and turns the light on. And that is just, that's very much what Isaac Watts is talking about in pursuing lifetime learning.
Yeah. So even talking about, obviously, literary pursuits, when we think about, say, pastoral ministry, obviously there's the move from sacred literature to other forms of literature is not as sort of challenging in terms of a move as other things could be. Are there other things, though, that say, as you know, as a pastor, when we think about Chalmers, did he have any kind of interest that maybe would surprise us to learn he had?
Well, he understood the necessity of taking care of his body.
Okay.
And so he was an avid walker, as so many Scotsmen were. He gave up golf because he said it was bad for his sanctification.
but he played.
Which is so wise.
But that's a fun story, obviously, for many.
Especially
but
up there near St. Andrews.
He loved to climb. He loved to climb when he would go out on these long hikes. Like Tolkien and Lewis used to do.
Right.
They would love to ramble, as they called it. So that was one of the things. Chalmers was also very interested in folk music.
Interesting.
And by folk music, I mean the regional distinctives in each part of Scotland. Mm. And so he loved to gather the various folk musicians to play. I recently did a little piece on nostalgia where I talked about the fact that, you know, do you remember when going out to dinner meant going out into the backyard and having dinner in the backyard? you remember when playing some music actually meant gathering everybody on the front porch and with mismatched instruments, and you just begin to sing at the top of your lungs and everybody is laughing and singing. Mm. Chalmers loved that kind of picture.
Yeah,
and it's the sort of thing that we see sort of sparked a little bit with Samuel Johnson and the Boswell account of his life, where he would gather at these parties, and Johnson would always call for music.
Mm-hmm.
Chalmers loved music, which, again, that's really interesting given the Scottish tradition of non-instrumental, non-hymnody, psalms-only worship.
Yeah.
But he loved Isaac Watts, for instance.
Yeah.
He just and would often sing as he walked. He was renowned as an excellent whistler.
That's an aspiration I've always had as a pastor. I wish I could whistle better. But that's fun. That's fun. That see, when we think about...
And for just an affirmation of you, he was a fine cartoonist.
Oh, was he? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's fun. Because I think sometimes we want to pigeonhole our spiritual heroes. We don't ever think about them doing anything that beside reading scripture or preaching or praying. You know, we don't have a sense of what their lives were like as a whole. And maybe some of the more endearing things about some of these people had to do with those things we just aren't aware of. Yeah. Like Chalmers the Great Whistler. I remember that now.
So. Or Robert Murray McShane loved to whittle.
Yeah.
He would, wherever he went, he had a little pocket knife and he would whittle.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah.
The question I have is, how many hours did he have in a day?
Yeah. Well, that's the question I have about a lot of people you know, like Kuiper, you know, he's like, what? You did what?
I'll never forget Mortimer Adler when he was giving his famous he was giving one of his talks on one of his students who he was trying to use Aquinas's five ways to show it could prove the existence of God, and the student was just not getting it, and he's like, I can't believe in, you know, God from this, and so finally, after hours, the student asked Mortimer Adler, "Would you tell me something else about Aquinas?" And he goes, "Well, he horseback rode about 13 hours a day." He said, "Why didn't you begin with that? There could never be someone who accomplished what he did and rode horseback 13 hours a day unless there was a God of that sort."
Right.
Well, this is fun. Now, with Chalmers, did he have children?
He had five daughters.
Oh, that you did mention the
daughters. Yeah, and two of them married pastors, and his oldest daughter, Anne, married William Hanna, who became the official biographer of Chalmers, and collected his letters and collected his sermons and editor of his memoirs.
So it sounds as though he had a really loving and fruitful relationship with those.
His wife, Grace, was an embodiment. She was a trophy of grace. And Fred Greco, when he was elected moderator yesterday, made the comment that he was able to do all of the things that he was able to do because his wife was there, not just as his helpmeet, but she was the one who really held the household together and held his life together.
Right.
And that was most assuredly true of Grace. Grace was an extraordinary woman. And their daughters were just incredible. One of the daughters, who never married, went on to become a philanthropist. She inherited wealth from an uncle who was in the shipping business, and she used that to plant churches. You know, one of the things that Chalmers did near the end of his life, in the last 5 years of his life, was he walked away from the Church of Scotland because of increasing liberalism and the intrusion of the government, and he helped to establish the Free Church of Scotland.
Right.
And in the last 5 years of his life, he was able to raise the money to build more than 400 churches, 500 schools, and all of the churches had parsonages so that the pastors who wound up being kicked out had a place to live. He did this in 5 years. And his this one daughter kind of took up the mantle, and she raised money to plant churches all over Scotland.
Wow. Yeah, marvelous stuff. Anyway, kind of overwhelming, too. You know, you kind of sit there and say, man, I've done nothing with my life.
We all kind of feel like we feel like hobbits.
We are hobbits.
So tell us a little bit about anything else you want to fill us in on for the next 10 minutes of the show or so.
Well, you know, one of the things that that you often talk about and a question that you often have is, so given how far we've gone in this culture, what hope do we have? How do we bring the sense of sanity back to our world? And there are a host of ways. We've been talking about all of them this whole time.
Right.
When we model before a watching world, this life filled with you know, brokenness, but gladness and joy, they see that and they know that there is something there. And oftentimes, when all is well, they don't want to pay attention and they don't want to hear.
Right.
But when the crisis comes and they need help or they need an answer, where do they go? They come to us.
Yep.
I think the great hope that we have in an age of cultural madness is not that we have better philosophies. We do. But the great hope is that we have a practical way to live out those philosophies with gladness and joy. We are planting gardens all around our culture right now. And those who live in the howling wasteland will catch a glimpse of the garden and say, oh, I need to go home.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is our great hope. We don't read books because we're eggheads. We read books because we know that we don't know everything that we need to know. And we've not yet become everything that we ought to be. And we've not yet done all that we ought to do. And so we're yearning to see sanctification go right down to our bones and shape us in every conceivable way to bring forth beauty, goodness, and truth, and a manifestation of the goodness of the kingdom to a watching world. Therein is great hope. Doug quoted Chesterton's quip about the church being thrown to the dogs seven times in church history. He and his dear friend, Hilaire Belloc, would often end their debates with people like George Bernard Shaw or H.G. Wells, and they would say, the church is a perpetually defeated thing, and she always survives her conquerors. And I think that that's something that we need to continue to recognize. We tend to get in the doldrums about the brokenness of our world, when in fact what we ought to do is, can you believe that God chose the likes of us to be the spokesman for the kingdom in this day and age? He didn't choose Luther. He didn't choose Calvin. He didn't choose Spurgeon. He didn't choose Chalmers. He chose Chris. He chose Glenn.
That's insane. That's just totally insane.
He chose Tom. He chose us. That's...
Wow. Yeah, that's great. That's great.
That's amazing.
Yeah, perspective, you know, we feel like at the moment as though the world is falling apart, and it is, but there will come a time when people will look at our point in history and say, man, I wish I could have lived during those glory days. Those were the days when being a Christian really cost you something, you know, that kind of thing.
And the churches that are really, really taking a stand are having to crawl through glass, as you said, but they're also seeing the fruit of kingdom faithfulness. They're growing. Churches all through COVID were growing while other churches were shutting their doors and going bankrupt. And that is an emblem of hope to remind us that the gospel is true, Christ is on the throne, his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and it shall not pass away. The kingdoms of this world are the kingdoms of our God and of his Christ. Or as Abraham Kuyper would say, there's still not one square inch in the whole domain of human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not say, mine.
Yeah, that's a great note to end on. Thanks, George, for coming and being with us.
Thank you.
It's been a fun conversation. Now, as we're wrapping up, you mentioned you've got some things that you're working on. Is there anything you want to leave with us in terms of a way for folks to keep in touch with you or follow what you're working on?
Sure, georgegrant.net.
There you go. That's easy. GeorgeGrant.net. All right. Well, thanks a lot. And thank you for listening to this episode of the Theology Podcast. Bye-bye.
The Theology Podcast is a ministry of Trinity Reformed Church in Huntsville, Alabama. If you liked this podcast, you might enjoy another one of our podcasts, Got a Minute, featuring Larson Hicks and Rich Lusk, theology, philosophy, economics, politics, and more for normal people.